From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. President Biden marked a very personal loss this Memorial Day weekend when he visited the gravesite of his son, Beau, who died of a brain tumor in 2015. The president has said he believes the cancer was linked to Beau's military service in Iraq. And today, President Biden laid a wreath at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier during a ceremony at Arlington National Cemetery.
Remember those who gave their all in the service of America, in the service of freedom, in the service of justice. Remember their sacrifice, their valor, and their grace. Remember their smiles, their loves, their laughter, their essential, vibrant, and transcendent humanity.
Also on this day, 100 years ago, a white mob descended on the all-black neighborhood of Greenwood in Tulsa, Oklahoma. They burned the neighborhood, known as Black Wall Street, to the ground, killing as many as 300, leaving thousands more injured and destitute. The incident would later become known as the Tulsa Race Massacre. And the city is now reckoning with its past. A commemoration event that would have been held today in the city's baseball stadium was abruptly canceled last week after a clash over reparations. Let's turn now to Nehemiah Frank, founder and editor-in-chief of the Black Wall Street Times. He's also a descendant of the historic Greenwood community, and he joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Nehemiah, you're actually at the Greenwood Community Center right now. What's it like there today?
Actually, I am not at the Greenwood Community Center right now. I'm at a cultural center right now. I'll be headed over there here shortly. I actually just attended a memorial service for those who died in 1921.
And that was
at Standpipe Hill.
Yes, I can imagine that the crowds were big. The scene was solemn. You know, I want to talk about the significance of today. But first, I want to acknowledge something. It wasn't that long ago that only Black Americans, for the most part, were the only ones talking about this massacre. Now the president is visiting tomorrow. Survivors have spoken before Congress. How does it actually feel to finally have what happened acknowledged?
I would say it's a breath of fresh air. You know, we knew that this was going to be a big moment in our city, in our nation's history. The racial reckoning and having a conversation about it. Now there's, you know, the whole world knows what happened here in Tulsa in 1921. So it is a breath of fresh air, but we're still focused on justice here. And we hope that we can get some reparations legislation passed here locally and, of course, H.R. 40.
Let's talk a little bit more about that ask and that ask for reparations as well as reconciliation within the city. How is that working?
I would say that it's not working out very well as of right now. You know, in order to repair the harm that was done in 1921, like restitution must be paid. You know, there are people here that say that, oh, well, that was 100 years ago. Even the mayor himself says that. He says, well, you know, the massacre was 100 years ago, and I'm not going to I'm not going to hold those who are living today for something that happened 100 years ago. Nevertheless, as you mentioned, we have three living survivors that were alive during that time, and two of them can remember what happened during the massacre.
And also, what I'm hearing from you here is that the ability to build generational wealth was stripped away. So that is why you're calling for reparations as well as some sort of reconciliation in the form not only of acknowledgement, but in monetary payment.
Right. I am so happy that you mentioned that.
Well,
yes. Yeah, so I'm so happy that you mentioned that. And the reason why is because you think about like institutional slavery. In 1865, that's when African-Americans received their emancipation. And so my ancestors, they received their emancipation in 1865. And then there's only 56 years from emancipation to 1921. Yeah. So they only have 56 years to build their wealth. And then they have it stripped away.
Thank you so much for sharing a little bit about what's happening there in Tulsa today and more on the Tulsa massacre and the impact that it's had on the people there. We look forward to having you on the
on the show later for more conversation. That's Nehemiah Frank, founder and editor-in-chief of the Black Wall Street Times. He's also a descendant of the Greenwood community.
Well, the governor of Ohio is getting ready to lift all pandemic restrictions on June 2nd, just a few days from now. So we thought we would check in again with Jessica Parkinson. She's co-owner of the restaurant Salt in Lakewood, Ohio, just outside of Cleveland. We've been keeping touch throughout the pandemic, and when we last spoke at the end of December, she said she was white-knuckling it at the restaurant, trying to hold on for a few more months.
If we can just get to June, I think once June hits, we're going to be okay. And I truly believe that. I do. I think that once the vaccine hits and people are getting vaccinated around us, it'll give people a little bit more comfort in going out and dining.
Well, let's see how it's going now. Jessica Parkinson, welcome back.
Hi there. Thank you for having me again.
Sure. And lo and behold, look at the calendar. It's almost June 1st. Right. Did you make it? How you doing?
We made it. We're doing well. Things are opening back up in Ohio. Mask mandates are lifted. Salt won't be going back to full capacity quite yet, though. We're having staffing issues, which I know a lot of places are. So.
Oh, yeah. Well, tell me about that. Yeah, lots of places are having trouble finding workers.
Yeah, so, you know, you get through this crazy pandemic, and then suddenly everything opens up, and now we're dealing with lack of staff. We're dealing with distribution issues. Last week, I couldn't get a beer order because the distribution was out of beer. It sounds to me like everything is opening up so quickly and everybody's so excited to get out of their house. And we're just having issues with that right now. So,
yeah. Well, maybe these are problems that you can deal with, right? I mean, do you think at this point you feel like you're kind of through the worst of it? Or are these problems still pretty significant for your business?
Yeah. I mean, these problems are significant for not only my business, but everybody's business. The restaurant is closed on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. I cannot open back up on those days because I'll wear my staff down. I've been washing dishes for the last 7 months. Serving-wise, we had almost 90 covers last night with three servers that had to keep the patio closed because I didn't have enough staff to be outside and inside at the same time. Customers are upset because they're finally getting out, so they're coming into your establishment, and you have to explain to them why you're out of certain things. They think it's your fault, not a distribution issue. So, I mean, you're dealing with different issues, but almost bigger issues. And I know I'm not the only one. I know, you know, a lot of my colleagues are going through this right now.
You know, the last time we spoke, I could hear it in your voice that you weren't doing well. I mean, I actually could hear it in your language as well. You were using words like dismal, treading water, white knuckling it. You know, you told me your business was down 80%. I mean, holy cow. I mean, what kind of words would you use today?
Today, I look at things like, it's really exciting to see customers back in your space. People that you haven't seen in 15 months, but we are literally exhausted emotionally, physically, mentally, and it's all around us within this business.
Have you thought about how you might get more workers in the door? I mean, maybe you got to raise wages or something.
I mean, we've done all of that. You know, I know a lot of people are complaining about restaurant owners and the way that they treat staff. And, you know, my business partner, Jill, and I are not that. I mean, we try and go above and beyond for our staff. I know other owners that do not, and that's fine. That's the way they run their business. I don't know what is happening with the staffing shortage. I don't know if it's the fact that everybody's sitting on unemployment still. I don't know if they're afraid to go back to work yet. I don't know what it is, but we have tried everything to get staffing in our door. They're just not out there. And they're not out there to do the work that really needs to get done. So that's like your dishwashers.
So you're doing it, right?
I'm doing it.
What have you learned through all this? I mean, it's now been more than a year. You've had some ups, you've had some downs, plenty of them. Mm-hmm. What are you taking away from this experience?
You know, I've really learned how to live day to day. Because every single day looks different. I've found out, especially over this year, how resilient not only I am, but my coworkers at SALT are. You go through this like roller coaster of emotions that's constant. If it's not the pandemic, it's a staffing issue. If it's not a staffing issue, it's a distribution issue. It's something new every day. So I really just have learned to live day to day and keep positive and try not to look down on that day. And I've gotten pretty good at it, so I'm pretty proud of that.
That's good. Good. Well, you should be proud of that. Not thrown in the towel yet, it sounds like.
No, not at all.
Jessica Parkinson, co-owner of the restaurant SALT in Lakewood, Ohio. We've been checking in throughout the course of this pandemic. It's great to hear from you again, and I hope that things continue to get better. I know it's been a tough road.
Thank you so much for having me back.
This is the day we set aside to honor Americans killed in service to our country, and we want to do that now with the family of one of the fallen. U.S. Army Corporal Jordan Good was killed in Afghanistan on August 11, 2007. He was the lead driver in a five-truck convoy when a roadside bomb exploded under his vehicle. He was 21 years old. Jordan grew up in Kalamazoo, Michigan. It's where his parents still live. And Sherry and Tony Good join us now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Tony and Sherry, how are you two doing?
Pretty good, I guess, depending on the day.
Doing pretty good. This is always a difficult time of year for us, of course.
Absolutely. You know, I had a chance to read a little about your son, Jordan, that he was adventurous and fearless and he loved to skateboard. And wow, Sherry, his smile, I bet he just melted your heart growing up.
Yeah, he did. And a lot of girls.
Oh my gosh, you all had the problem of a lot of girls. Tell us a little about him.
Where do I start? He was our middle child. He was a big protector of his brothers. You always wanted Jordan on your side because he would go to the ends of the earth to protect you and make sure that everything was okay. He was an artist. He actually had a scholarship to go to art school and he chose not to do that.
He was that guy. It started at an early age. He must have been about 5 years old when it first cracked out. And he protected his older brothers from some problem bullies he was having on a bus one day. We were both standing at the door with our mouths open.
What a leader he was. What do you think it was in him that really brought out those leadership qualities in him?
It's just his love for people. I took him to work with me one day when he was about 13 or 14. All the women that I worked with after he left said, "You can bring him back anytime."
Jordan enlisted in 2005. Why did he want to join?
A few reasons, actually. He had just found out that his girlfriend was pregnant. He wanted to provide for his family. They ended up getting married. And that was his push. He didn't want to go to college. It would take too long. And he wanted the best for his little girl.
And I also think that I recall when he was in middle school, 9/11 had just occurred. He came home that day and it was one of those events that changed all of us. But, you know, you never suspect that it would affect a young person that hard. And we had many, many conversations about 9/11. From all sides of it. And I think that was one of those things where he thought maybe, you know, if he got involved, that he could be a help.
Yeah.
He joined because he wanted to provide for his daughter, Amira, your granddaughter. Mm-hmm. She was just 2 years old when he was killed. And now she's a teenager.
Yeah.
What is she like?
Oh, she is a she version of him. She looks like him. She acts like him. She's a jokester like him. She truly embodies him.
You know, Sherry, I opened up those photos that you all sent, and I knew that was his daughter the moment I saw her. I just thought, if that's not his daughter, I don't know who is. She does look just like him. She reminds you a lot of him.
A lot.
Yes, she does.
Every day.
Yep. And especially in her humor, she has taken his place as the humorist in our house.
Jordan met his wife, Aubrey, around the same age your granddaughter is now. I mean, so much time mm-hmm. has passed. Do you mm-hmm. all think about that often?
Yeah, it's hard to believe that that much time has went by and to watch her grow into a young woman who will soon be graduating, you know? It's kind of like a full circle moment, I guess. Not a great one, because he's not here to share it.
Yeah. You know, we often ask families who have lost loved ones this really unfair question of, does it get any easier over time? And it is an unfair question, isn't it? Because it lives with you every second of the day.
It does. I tell people it's different. It gets different, not easier, because that hole is always in your heart, for sure. But when you meet people along the way, like when we go to TAPS events and we meet other parents who are going through the same thing, it definitely eases the path for us to walk.
And TAPS stands for Tragedy Assistance Program for Survivors. It's an organization for other families like you.
Yeah, TAPS has become a huge part of our family, allowing us to grieve it's hard to say positive fashion, but they help in so many ways with all the resources they provide and all the programs mm-hmm. that are available to us, and especially connecting people with people who understand each other, who get the grief, who understand the difficulty of being surviving parents of lost loved ones to anything connected. If they were involved with the military and they were in an automobile accident or it was a suicide, TAPS is there for people. Just a wonderful program.
It definitely sounds like it. You know, why it's so important to check in with families like yours is because we also have to understand the loss and we have to grieve with you because of the sacrifice your son made on behalf of all of us. How will you be remembering him today?
We'll go through his pictures. We'll go through his last videos. We'll talk about him.
We'll share stories. It's difficult. We'll cry. And we'll laugh and we'll eat some of his favorite foods.
Yeah.
Oh, what are some of his favorite foods?
Oh gosh. He loved my macaroni and cheese.
Yeah. I was going to say that. Mac and cheese, mom's mac and cheese.
You bet.
That was his favorite. And he always asked me to make it. And he told everybody about it, which is just hilarious to me. And chicken was his thing. Chicken, no matter what.
You know, it occurred to me that I brought up the attributes that we know based on the writing about your son. But what is it that you'd like for us to know about him?
He was a wonderful, loving, spirited young man who doted on his daughter and his wife. He was very serious about his commitment to the military. And, you know, I'd love to hear his voice again now when he called me home. He called me up when he jumped out of an airplane and his jump master gave him the phone and told him, you need to call somebody and tell him what you did. And it was the most excited I ever heard him in all my life. Many calls ensued after that. They were all calls, you know, looking forward to being home and seeing family, and just this very loving young man who was always in your corner.
It helps to talk about him.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it does quite a bit. It helps a lot. And that's another one of those opportunities we get when we go to the TAPS events is we get the opportunities to talk about those attributes and the attributes of other folks who put that uniform on at different times throughout all these conflicts. 30 years ago, there probably wasn't anything like this. And now, you know, so many survivors later, here we are. And, you know, again, we have all the resources that my granddaughter's been able to go to things mm-hmm. like Good Grief Camps. I've been to a few retreats.
For men.
Men's retreats in Montana and Colorado. Mm-hmm. And they actually really helped me open up because I was rather resistant to talking about this. And it's really brought me out of my shell in that regard. And now I'm able to, you know, help other people in that situation as a peer mentor. And Sherry's also a mentor, and I've just received my first assignment. And
how are you feeling? What is your assignment?
We just talk with other survivors.
What an important role, an important but also probably an honor for you.
It is an honor to be able to help someone else walk that path, so to speak.
Before I let you go, I want to ask you something. We want to have a little piece of Jordan to go out on. Can you tell us what his favorite song was, or maybe favorite musical artist?
Anything that had to do with rap or hip hop.
Yeah.
Tupac. Mm-hmm.
And Bone Thugs, I Hope You Never Forget Me. That was Jordan's song.
Yeah.
That was his song.
Yeah.
Sherry and Tony Good, their son, Army Corporal Jordan Good, was killed in Afghanistan in 2007. Sherry and Tony, thank you for sharing a bit of him with us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
On NPR's Rough Translation,
there's just fewer people that know somebody that's in the military.
After 20 years of war, are civilians and military farther apart than ever?
They were asking me, do you want to hear this? Do you want to know us?
Listen to Homefront, the new season of Rough Translation.
Big news out of China today. The government is lifting a policy that forbids families from having more than two children. Chinese officials said that married couples may now have up to three kids after recent data showed a dramatic decline in births in the world's most populous country. Robin Farzad is host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Robin, thanks for spending some of your holiday weekend with us.
Thank you, Peter.
And why the change in China? And why now?
Last year, the number of births in China came in at 12 million, which represented four straight years of decline. So you're simultaneously seeing a spike in the percentage of Chinese people aged 60 and above to about 19% from, let's say, 13% a decade ago. So if it all continues on this path, you run into an imbalance with too many retirees and pensioners, depending on just a paucity of young workers to grow the economy.
Well, remember back just a few years ago, 2016, China lifted an even longer standing policy that limited people to having just one child. Doing that didn't encourage a lot of families to have bigger families. So what are the chances that that would change this time around?
The worry is it's pushing on a string that there are many other exigencies at play. I mean, granted, China has taken a record number of people out of poverty over just three decades. And that has entailed so many Chinese trading agrarian life for the cities. But then that entails modernity, healthcare, birth control, education, childcare. In 2013, Beijing relented and allowed couples to have two children when one of the parents was an only child. When that didn't work enough, in 2015, it said that it would allow all couples to have up to two children. Now it's sweetening the pot to three children. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of skeptical that, you know, it's not the bottleneck anymore, how many kids you can have. It's the support you need around it.
Well, exactly. Some people are going on social media to say that they can't even afford to have one child in this modern Chinese economy. What's the government doing about that? Are they trying to help these families along?
Beijing is hinting at more benefits for childbearing by easing access to educational resources and maybe cutting or subsidizing individual workers have to spend on educational expenditures. But you wonder if and when this will all extend to more egalitarian childcare and healthcare, kind of the trappings of a developed market, pension reform. Women, for one, who want to work into a professional track, they could be more inclined to postpone childbirth. That's something that you see that goes with becoming a developing economy to a more developed Western one. So this is a kind of a coming of age conversation for the economy.
Well, exactly, because fundamentally here, China is trying to stay competitive in a global economy. So what does this new policy tell you about what's at stake for China?
China, of course, does not want to become Japan, which has been mired in economic stagnation for 3 decades now. There are many elderly people who die alone in Japan. Famously, more adult diapers are sold there than baby ones. So you have seen decades of runaway public spending just to keep the economy glued. The stakes are far bigger for China. It's a $15 trillion, $16 trillion economy that's vying to become the planet's top economy and capture the global economic story this century. So they have to get this right.
Robin Farzad is host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. It's always great to speak with you. Thanks for coming on.
Likewise. Thank you.
It's Memorial Day, and Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin was among the dignitaries who spoke during a ceremony at Arlington National Cemetery this morning.
Our Gold Star and surviving families wage a fight that goes on long after the funerals. And it is our sacred duty to do more to ease the burden that they shoulder on Memorial Day and every day.
Our next guest is part of a Gold Star family, and on this Memorial Day, he asks the question, who should be responsible for the death of my son? Andrew Basevich's son, Andrew Jr., was killed in Iraq 14 years ago in 2007. Recently, Basevich received a letter in the mail from a law firm asking his family to join a lawsuit against Iran in connection with his son's death. The retired Army colonel rejected the offer, but the letter made him wrestle with that ever-present question about who to blame. Basevich recently wrote about this in the Boston Globe, and he joins us now. And you've been weighing this question about who to hold responsible for your son's death for a while now, and this latest was prompted by a letter. What did it say?
Well, it was a letter from a Washington law firm to me and my wife. The letter claimed to be speaking on behalf of hundreds of Gold Star families. And the gist of the letter was that the law firm was going to sue the government of Iran, holding the government of Iran responsible for my son's death and the deaths of many other Americans. And presumably we were going to all then cash in as a result of this lawsuit.
You tossed this letter in the trash, but it left you with that question about responsibility. Does Iran share some of that responsibility? Is there actually a case for that?
I don't think so, at least not in my estimation. I should be clear. I'm not an apologist for the Iranian regime. It's not democratic. It causes a lot of trouble in the region. But by any objective measure, the Iranian response to the American invasion of Iraq, which was to offer assistance to Iraqi resistance forces, was quite rational, quite predictable, and dare I say it, even justified. Were hostile forces to invade Canada, for example, surely we would respond in a similar way. In other words, we would provide material support to Canadians who were resisting foreign occupying forces.
You've always been a critic of the Iraq War and President Bush's decision to launch it back in 2003. But ultimately, you've decided that placing the responsibility for your son's death on Iran, and even to a lesser extent, President Bush is just evading the questions that we, the people, you say, should carry that responsibility. Can you say more about this?
Well, we're a democracy. We proclaim proudly that we are a democracy. When American soldiers go fight, whether it's in Iraq or Afghanistan or Europe or the Far East, we insist that they are fighting for democracy. And therefore, it seems to me, when we search for the ultimate explanation for our wars, we have to find that explanation in our democracy. You know, it is not true that any administration, the Biden administration, the Trump administration, that, on a day-to-day basis, they express the will of the American people. But I think cumulatively, they do. So the post-9/11 wars, one of which claimed my son's life, we, the people, either tacitly or explicitly, allowed those wars to happen. We can't pass off the blame onto a particular president. We have to recognize that there is a collective aspect of why our nation does what it does, either at home or abroad.
What you're saying is crystal clear, but I'm wondering what your thinking be different if someone were killed in a war for which there was broad public support, like World War II.
I don't think that I'd have a different explanation. As a matter of fact, that if we take World War II as a popular war and one in which the moral stakes were far clearer than the moral stakes in Iraq, then it becomes all the plainer. Yes. Mm-hmm. That the Americans who died fighting to liberate France and to destroy Nazi Germany and to bring down the Japanese Empire, they died on behalf of we the people. Matter of fact, I think to some degree the continuing preeminence of World War II in our collective historical imagination stems from what we perceive to be the clarity of World War II. The Iraq War, Afghanistan War, the Vietnam War, in which I served, none of those conflicts had comparable moral clarity. And all of them, to some degree, featured some amount of popular resistance. But in no case was the popular resistance sufficient to make the war go away. So I keep coming back to the notion that, yeah, the Americans who died in those wars, whether they were good wars or bad wars, they died on behalf of we the people.
Yeah. This is what you're reflecting on this Memorial Day.
Yes.
Is it what you're asking us to reflect on?
You know, I think it's presumptuous of me to ask others to reflect on anything, but I would say this. You know, you and I are speaking near Boston, and we have a wonderful tradition here in our Commonwealth that in anticipation of Memorial Day, we volunteers put flags on Boston Common, one flag for every resident of Massachusetts going back to 1775 who's given his life or her life for our country. That's over 37,000 flags. Mm. My wife and I went out there the other day to help install them. It's a beautiful remembrance. And it's just my hope that in remembering as we do, that we also take that next step to ask ourselves, what is our responsibility for all those deaths? I think we have some. And I think if we ignore that responsibility, that collective responsibility, then I think our democracy is diminished as a consequence.
Andrew, what do we do with that responsibility once we acknowledge that we as individuals and collectively as Americans are responsible? What do we do?
I think we have to ask ourselves, what does it mean to be a citizen today? What does it mean to be a citizen at a moment when, of course, the country is deeply divided for all sorts of reasons? What does it mean to be a citizen at a time when we are reckoning with some very uncomfortable elements of our past, particularly with regard to race? I think there is an urgent need for us to reckon with parts of our military history that are also uncomfortable. And then to say, okay, what am I supposed to do about it? I mean, what is my role as an individual, as a democratic citizen? And I wouldn't presume to suggest that there is sort of one answer to that question. But I think I would say that in this particular moment of our history, coming to an answer, one that's, you know, satisfies us as individuals, I think it's really, really important.
Andrew Bacevich, a retired Army colonel who served in Vietnam and is now president of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. He has a book coming out shortly called After the Apocalypse. Andrew, as always, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Oh, thank you very much.
Tomorrow marks the start of the 2021 Atlantic hurricane season, and the federal government predicts it will be more active than normal, with 13 to 20 named storms. Climate change in general is bringing more frequent and intense storms all along the Atlantic coast, and that is a concern to people who live on Pearl Avenue in Revere, Massachusetts, just north of Boston. Pearl Avenue is a quiet street with beautiful views of the ocean. Residents say it's a great place to raise kids. Problem is, it often floods. Miriam Wasser from member station WBUR brings us the story.
22-year-old Samantha Woodman grew up in a small white house on Pearl Ave.
I absolutely love this street. My whole family is on here, so it's really nice because we always used to just go over each other's houses at night. Then it's like, this is my aunt's house right here. So it was a very nice neighborhood to grow up in.
But growing up here also meant that flooding was just part of life. That's because Pearl Ave borders a tidal marsh, and its eastern end is right by the ocean. Woodman says it was normal for people's lawns to disappear underwater during storms or really high tides.
I remember there was a storm when I was much younger, and the house across the street, that gray one right there, they had these bins in the back full of toys or whatever that we used to play with, and all of that was carried out to the marsh.
Until a few months ago, the Woodmans rented a house several lots in from the ocean end of the street. It was a part of the neighborhood that didn't usually see much flooding. But in January 2018, a big nor'easter hit, and Pearl Ave was absolutely pummeled.
2018 was a time I want to forget, a time most of us want to forget.
That's Samantha's mom, Dawn Woodman. As high tide approached, huge waves crested a nearby seawall, and the water in the marsh was rising fast. The Woodmans' heat had gone out a few days earlier, so they were actually staying with friends across town as the storm hit.
My cousin Sandy was sending me the videos and the pictures, and I was like, oh my God, oh my God, and I'm not even there to do anything.
When they returned the next day, their car, and at least 20 other cars on the street, was stuck in the ice, totaled. The family's only means of transportation was gone.
It was a huge deal. You know, we're not wealthy. We scrape by. I'm a single mom, two kids, two girls. It was hard. It was heartbreaking.
Across the street, things also got really bad for Christine Lavigueur and her husband. Their house abuts the marsh, which had basically merged with the choppy ocean water during the storm.
We evacuated. We actually evacuated. The water was up to my husband, the middle of his chest, in the basement. The washer and dryer were sparking. We had to shut the electrical panel off. We called the fire department, they came and got us and put us someplace while we waited for our ride to come and get us.
A few weeks later, they were hit by another big storm, and then another in March.
Through the years, with all the climate changes, the water seems to be getting higher and higher each year. So it's more of a challenge. When I first came here, it wasn't that bad, you know.
So why does she stay? Why does anyone stay? Well, her husband grew up on this street. She knows all of her neighbors. She can hear the ocean at night. Yes, 2018 was really bad, she says. But in general, the benefits outweigh the risks. Down the street, Samantha Woodman's aunt, Sandra Castelloren, feels the same. A few years ago, she acquired an empty lot from her father, who lives next door, and built a new house a few hundred feet from the ocean.
It seems kind of bold to decide to build a house.
I knew that question would come, and you know, I grew up here, so I knew what to expect.
There's a 5-foot crawl space underneath her house that's designed to flood. The 2018 storm caused some damage anyway. She lost all of her Christmas decorations, lawn furniture, and anything else stored below the house. Castelloren says she knows there are some people out there who will hear her story and say she's irresponsible, that everyone on the street is irresponsible for staying.
Well, that's a tough one. I mean, I understand that. And I myself, you know, think, was it irresponsible? But it's not going to be tomorrow that none of us can live here anymore. And I guess probably because I've lived here so long. You know, I grew up here, so it's tough.
Castelloren says she knows the sea levels are rising, but she feels strongly that the neighborhood is worth protecting. City officials, meanwhile, say there isn't much to be done. Even if they fortified the neighborhood with 10-foot seawalls, the water would still come up from below ground because this whole area was once ocean and marshland.
I think anyone can make the argument to save areas because it's about worth to yourself. It's about how you feel about a certain place. And the people that live there tend to care more about the place and they want to keep it for as long as possible.
Samantha Woodman is now a senior in college. She says the experience of growing up here, and in particular, the devastating storm of 2018, has inspired her to become a climate activist and study sustainability. She understands that Pearl Ave will be underwater in a few decades, but she hopes the neighborhood lasts long enough that she can show it to her future kids before it's gone. For Here and Now, I'm Miriam Wasser.
Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.